I'd like now to introduce Adam Harvey. He is an actor whose upcoming performance at Theater Work is called Finnegan's Wake, The Tale of Shem the Penman. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you. Now, this opens at Theater Work on July 7th. It runs July 7th, 8th, and 9th. Now, Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce is known as one of the most difficult books in the English language. Mm-hmm. And you have been studying this, perhaps it's not wrong to say obsessively, for the last 10 years.
I would have to say that I was saved from being diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder in that this work has allowed me to actually present something to the public that's of use, you know, and instead of like mere fetishism, I actually have something to show.
Well, this is something that I want to talk about because okay. I think maybe that's the wrong word, but it's certainly a major occupation in your life, taking something which is a huge work in English literature and a very difficult work and bringing it to a theater audience.
Right, right.
What's involved with that? What's that process all about?
Well, I got involved in this to start with. I got involved in this because I was just as an actor, I think probably my real obsession, although it eventually became literature and Joyce, started off as acting, and I was really fascinated with just the craft of acting and trying to get acting, trying to kind of push the envelope as far as what the actual craft was capable of, what I was capable of within the craft, and particular human expression. And it seemed to me like Finnegan's Wake was a great material to start with. And in particular, the idea of taking this language, which is so multivalent, it travels all over the world, and it goes through all sorts of different channels of thought and emotion and ideas and feelings and so on. And it seemed to me like that using this text would be a great kind of training ground for kind of discovering what my limits are, what I can do within those limits and so on. And about 12 years ago, I embarked upon studying literature of James Joyce. I mean, all of it. Because in order to understand Finnegan's Wake, you have to understand Ulysses. In order to understand Ulysses, you have to go into Portrait and Dubliners and so on.
Here's kind of a trick question. What is Finnegan's Wake about?
Finnegan's Wake is about the universe as we know it and even the universe as we don't know it. It's a language that is actually an attempt at recreating a universal human experience, not through any kind of semantic understanding of it, because you're not going to get that. Even if you study all the different languages, Joyce peppered in about 70 or so different foreign tongues into his text. Even if you study all of that, there's still a sense of unbelievable abstraction.
How do you, confronted with this not only long and difficult, but just vast work of art on a humanistic level, mm-hmm. make a short theater piece? I mean, it's an exercise in selection for you.
Right. Well, what I decided to do, I mean, Finnegan's Wake has been interpreted for the theater in the past, but it was always kind of a cut and paste thing. They took one paragraph that they thought they could get their heads around, and then they would add that to another section of the book and so on. And then they would edit out, they would take out this word that didn't make any sense anyway, that kind of stuff. I decided that all of this was an indication that they just didn't trust Joyce and his compositional skills. After all, the man spent 17 years writing this book, and he would spend as much as 14 hours on two sentences, on maybe two lines of text. My thought was, let's trust the text. Let's start at a place where Joyce starts and take it all the way to the end of that chapter. Leave nothing out and add nothing to it. And so in the selecting, I decided that it would be performances of entire chapters. That way you're dealing with what Joyce intended this experience to be.
Now, you've been an actor all your life, and your preoccupation with Joyce always had in it, I guess, this intention to do theater and to develop theater pieces.
Right. Yeah, always. From the very start, I took up Joyce on the assumption that this was going to be something that could be performed. And that's actually, that was not any kind of new revelation on my part. I mean, a lot of people have performed Joyce. In fact, One of the favorite things to do at Joyce events, generally June 16th, which is known as Bloomsday, is to read it out loud. And it does make for an entirely different experience than just sitting down with the written word. It makes it experiential. It makes it corporeal. it puts it into your body, and then it becomes a vehicle for expression. And generally, I've not known too much variance in interpretation of the text. I mean, once you know what the text is saying, then pretty much it channels you right through it. The text guides you into the proper interpretation of it. Of course, you have to study all of the different things that Joyce put into it, all the different literary allusions, all the different place names, all the different historical events that Joyce wanted us to know about. I mean, that's a good thing to study, especially as an actor. But once you're up on the stage and once you're up there performing it, it becomes an entirely different thing where you just simply have the experience right there in front of you. And although there isn't a semantic understanding of it, at least there's some kind of, at least there's an experience hitting you. And understanding does come.
Now, there's an experience hitting you, mm-hmm. and within that experience, there are certain big themes about life itself. What are some of the themes in the work of James Joyce, and in particular in Finnegan's Wake, that have really interested you?
Well, I think the one that right now is really has really got me going is this idea that there's a reality out there wherein the things we use to distinguish ourselves from each other, like even things like gender, age, race, class, personality, size of nose, all of these things that we use generally to distinguish ourselves are in fact completely illusory. These are things that we only understand during our waking hours. As soon as we fall asleep, all of that vanishes in an instant.
It sounds like a kind of Buddhist dissolution of the ego.
Well, yeah, Joyce did actually read some Buddhism when he was quite young and when he was trying to split from the Catholic Church. Into which he was born, and which had a tremendous effect on him. He was searching for other paradigms and other ways of understanding the world around him, and he did pick up Olcott's Buddhist Catechism. Oddly enough, he picked
Buddhist
up a book
Catechism.
Called The Buddhist Catechism, and it's an interesting little book, and some other books, Henry Clark Warren's Buddhism in Translation, and others. And so I think, although there's not a whole lot of reference to Buddhism in his works, I think that he avoids direct reference in order to encapsulate the ideas that he embraced when he was young.
Now, the style of writing that you read in Finnegan's Wake and in Ulysses by James Joyce is what people call stream of consciousness. But when the author was crafting this stuff, he wasn't doing stream of consciousness the way,
no.
you know, Jack Kerouac and On the Road with a long
right.
roll of paper going through the typewriter and
no,
stuff.
No, indeed not.
What was the process like of writing these things? I mean, the idea that Finnegan's Wake took 17 years to
yeah.
write, that's huge.
Right. Well, part of what he was going for, particularly in Ulysses with stream of consciousness, it's Ulysses that really is kind of considered his tour de force of stream of consciousness. It's different from what you would get in Kerouac. Kerouac is pretty much first person. These are my thoughts as I'm writing them. Whereas Joyce tried to put himself into the thoughts of another person, another character, including a woman. I mean, this idea of being able to kind of transmigrate your soul over to another person, kind of the way I was describing, where we're all supposed to be indistinguishable from each other in this ultimate reality. So he, of course, wrote that very, very famous chapter at the end of Ulysses in which a woman is lying in bed thinking about the day's events. And it's an absolutely fascinating journey through the mind of a woman. Most people, I can't believe that a man would have written it. But the idea here was what Joyce called the transmigration of a soul, the idea of being able to move over into that other mindset. But in order to do that, he had to very carefully construct that stream of consciousness. He had to work with the idioms that would be within that person's psyche, those things that surround that person in their daily lives that would not surround another person. I mean, so much of our thoughts deal with the particulars of what we're dealing with, like my cat, not his dog. So it involved a tremendous amount of research on Joyce's part in order to recreate another human being. Anyway, Finnegan's Wake is an extension of that, to kind of bring us back to Finnegan's Wake, except that Finnegan's Wake is an attempt at dream consciousness. In other words, what would stream of consciousness be like if we could recreate it in the mind of a sleeping person instead of a waking person?
So the whole thing is a recreation of a night of dreams?
I think that's an excellent way of approaching Finnegan's Wake. The idea is that when we go to sleep, all of our notions of self-identity vanish, and even gender becomes questionable. I mean, you can certainly have a dream in which you've switched, you know. And in many cases, particularly for somebody who tries to hold on to their ego and tries to hold on to that sense of self-identity, very often the dream will represent the exact opposite of what they're trying to hold on to. And it can become a rather threatening experience for them, particularly the male mindset, like the male patriarchal mindset. So what happens then is that this mindset kind of it struggles with all of these different other paradigms that are moving through him or trying to move through him. He puts resistance up. Every now and then he relinquishes himself. Ultimately, what happens then as a result of this experience is it can't possibly be looked at as the dream of a single person. After all, he's been journeying from persona to persona throughout this book. So ultimately, you can't say that it's the dream of a single ego. In fact, it could be looked at in Jungian terms as kind of a collective dream. And hence, Joyce then starts peppering in different foreign languages, different idioms from even everything from Bowery slang to like high cotton, from Southern black dialect that he picked up from Mark Twain to Chinese to Swahili. And all of these different languages have their own color. They represent a new mindset. Clearly, what Joyce was shooting for was something a good deal more than just those particulars that he was working with Ulysses, where this individual has these specific thoughts. Every now and then an ego is going to grab onto it and say, I'm the one in charge, but he can never hold on to it too long.
We're talking to Adam Harvey. The upcoming performance at Theater Work this weekend is called Finnegan's Wake, The Tale of Shem the Penman. Let's talk about James Joyce and the illusion that he is exactly one person who lived in a particular time and space.
Oh, that's a great way of putting it. For one thing, yes, Joyce's works were made possible through an enormous effort by a community of people, including his family, including his patron. His patroness, Harriet Shaw Weaver, there was a whole community of people that believed in him. And in order for him to sit down and work on this text, he did not do other work. Once it was time to sit down and write Ulysses, he had secured patronage for himself, and he spent all day long sitting, thinking about writing or writing. Like I said, you know, 14 hours for two sentences.
Good heavens.
Yeah.
and at the same time, he must have been part of the world in order to write about it. I mean,
yeah. Oh, well, it's that comes from his childhood and his college education, because he kind of experienced. He was both upstairs and downstairs. He was born into a fairly affluent family whose wealth vanished as a result of the bad habits of his father. And so by the time he was maybe 12, 13, his family had fallen into some pretty bad straits. And by the time he was, say, 16 and going to college, his family had spent all of their money on giving him a great education and on his father's drinking. And those are the two things that they spent their money on. Kids starved in his family in order to give him, in order to give him the education that he needed in order to be this great writer.
Good heavens. So he was recognized early.
He was recognized very early. He wrote he won this essay contest, an extraordinarily prestigious essay contest when he was about 16, I think. And that brought in some income for the family, which immediately went out the door with extravagant spending, believing that they could then regain that kind of sense of prestige that they had when he was younger. And but of course, once he moved into the Bowery, he was exposed to an entirely different world. A world of kind of living day to day. Will the stomach be filled today? And discovering the culture of that world as well. He discovered the culture of the brothels. And when he moved to Paris when he was 1902, he then experienced abject, horrible poverty when he was there. Wound up having to move back to Dublin and to tend to his mother when she died. He eventually exiled himself from Ireland and moved to Trieste, Italy. and did start finally making a name for himself. During all of this, of course, people that were quite famous, William Butler Yeats, Lady Gregory, George Moore, had all recognized his talent and were talking him up. But he was very slow to write. I mean, it took Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, a very small book, took 10 years to write.
Good heavens.
Yeah, yeah. And Ulysses took 7 years to write. And Finnegan's Wake, of course, took 17. But, I mean, when you think about what it must have taken for Joyce to kind of maintain himself while he was very carefully and methodically constructing these texts. Yes, he was exposed to a real world out there.
Now, all these biographical details, which you have just mentioned, mm-hmm. the abject poverty and the brothels and the high society and the literary patrons, mm-hmm. all those find their way into this work.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He didn't leave anything out. He was he pretty much just laid himself bare. And I think part of it had to do, I mean, when you think about, I can't imagine what it would be like to see your own siblings starve while you are hanging out with, you know, with these upper middle class medical students and just drinking it up with them in order to make connections, in order to inject yourself into that society. And meanwhile, it must have made him feel very much like that his life was not his own, that he had to absolutely commit himself to this aesthetic. And I think it was that sense of obligation that caused him to be so rigorous in his composition and not just sit down and say, oh, I've got some great ideas, let's just type them in.
No. And that rigor is something that may not appear at first glance to those who are reading something that seems to them, to the reader, like stream of consciousness.
Right. Because ultimately what you're describing is a single moment, a single thought that pops into someone's head. But, I mean, for Joyce to describe it accurately and succinctly would take a day, take a week. Sometimes he'd lay it aside and sit down and think before he could finally come up with the right way of putting it.
Now, how was James Joyce's work, especially Ulysses and then Finnegan's Wake, received by critics, received by other writers and artists of the time, those people who were supporting him, the general public?
Well, it's interesting. With each new book, he received a whole new group of admirers. And, of course, he lost all the old ones. So the ones who really liked Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man pretty much dropped him when they saw Ulysses. They were, no, this stuff is way too
it's
deep for
too
me.
Far out.
Can't handle it. And all the people that had gone to the trouble of understanding Ulysses and reading it and then just said, you've really pushed it too far with this Finnegan's Wake stuff. I can't handle it. But of course, a whole new group of people came along and embraced Finnegan's Wake and put their energies into kind of supporting him while he tried to get this thing finished, which he barely did. I mean, he died only 2 years after it was published.
What about the general public? I mean, it takes a lot of work mm-hmm. to read Finnegan's Wake or Ulysses today. And in fact, you're involved in a group that gets together once a week and goes through word by word, sentence by sentence, trying to understand it. What about, the reader who goes to the bookstore, buys the book, pays their money, comes home, opens it?
Right.
In his time.
With his own time. Well, I mean, one of the things, and I think it can be mistaken for extraordinary arrogance on Joyce's part to expect his reader to spend the kind of time that is required of a reader to understand this literature. My thoughts on that are that Joyce was a servant to this literature. He had indentured himself to creating this aesthetic, and it was the aesthetic itself that he gave his life over to. And in that sense, it's actually, you can look at it as, I mean, you can question whether or not it's worthwhile to relinquish your own ego over to this work. But once it's been done, it's actually quite a worthwhile experience to sit down and look at what language is truly capable of, because that was what Joyce was really shooting for, was an understanding of how language can be used to describe experience, because language is a tricky and clumsy thing. And it takes work in order to express the ideas you're looking for. And
now, were there any precedents? Were there people who were doing something similar that Joyce was able to follow? Was he standing on the shoulders of some work before?
Oh,
or did
goodness.
was this just born somehow out of
no, it was, it, yes, it was born somehow, but that somehow had to do with everything that came before it. including, I mean, everything from the Greeks, you know, on up. He was extraordinarily well-read. He just consumed books like you would eat dinner. I mean, he just read and read and read and read. And so the history that preceded him is his work is inundated. It's saturated with these things. And so part of the trick in reading Joyce is, of course, that you have to kind of subject yourself to your own little liberal arts education. If you get the chance to go to St. John's College, now's your, you know.
And even if you did.
Even if you did, you got to go back over that stuff. Sure, absolutely. His big influences, you know, it's difficult to say because, I mean, he was such an individual, but he was constantly lifting phrases, lifting little turns of language from this author and that author. Shakespeare. I mean, he's a huge, huge influence. Ibsen, Henrik Ibsen, actually, he borrowed from, not necessarily for his language, but for his themes and what he studied, in particular the feminism. Joyce was very moved by early feminism. Although it doesn't appear to be in his works at first, it's actually informed by that, I think probably because of that desire of his to try and transmigrate over to that feminine mindset.
We're talking to Adam Harvey. Even more than the influence that others had on him, there's a huge influence that he had on those who followed.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, I mean, Joyce informs 20th century literature. I mean, everything from Samuel Beckett to Thomas Pynchon to Tom Stoppard and others. What you were talking about stream of consciousness and so on, and of course you can't help but think about the Beats and, you know, where would they have been without Joyce to sit down and trip out on, you know, absolutely. That's a huge, huge subject is Joyce's influence on the literature that came after him. And I think studying that literature in light of Joyce is another just fascinating field of study.
I was wondering if you would read a section from Finnegan's Wake.
Oh, okay, sure. The passage I have here in light of what you just asked has to do with a potential influence that Joyce had on Theodore Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss. This is a passage that looks like prose, but actually if you read it carefully, you'll see that he's written it in verse. Here it is. If you met on the bench a poor exiled from ailing, when the tune of his tremble shook shimmy on shin, while his contrary raged in the week of his wailing, like a rugilant, pugilant Lion O'Lynn, if he maundered in misliness, plaining his plight, or played fox and lice pricking and dropping hips teeth, or wringing his handcuffs for peace, the blind blighter, praying Gufan Dom Nostrum's foe thone thinks to eath, if he weeped while he leaped, and guffawed quith a quimper, made cold blood a blue Monday, and no bones without fleck, taking kiss, cake, or kick with the suck, sigh, or simper, a diffle a larn, and a dibble to lech. If the fain shinner pegged you to shave his immartial, wee skill mustard shull with his ooh, hoo doo doo, broking wind to that wiles, woe made sin he was partial, we don't think, Jones, we'd care to this evening, would you?
That is so Dr. Seuss.
I know. Well, I mean, you almost want to start saying, yeah, I am Sam, Sam I am, you know.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and Geisel definitely read Joyce, and I think he probably skimmed through Finnegan's Wake and had a look at that, and he definitely read Ulysses, and I think he would have been awfully curious to see what Finnegan's Wake was all about.
Now, the passage you just read, I mean, it's as you say, it's sort of like entering somebody else's dream,
right?
But can you tell us and those out in Radioland what that was about?
If you sit down with say some supplementary notes, and actually even if you don't, you can kind of have a look at Joyce's words here. Basically, the question it's a very long way of asking a very simple question: would you help a poor man lying in the dirt? Would you help him? Would you pick him up? Would you dust him off? Would you get him a bite to eat? Would you go to the trouble of helping somebody in need? I mean, that's basically. It's a long way of asking that question.
Which reminds one of the question of somebody whose siblings are not getting enough to eat.
Well, yeah, exactly. And the answer given is about 20 pages long. I mean, that was a question, by the way, if you didn't hear that. That was what I just read was a very long question. And the answer given is basically no, I wouldn't do it. But the fellow who answers this question can't be satisfied with an answer of so simple. I mean, he would immediately be excoriated as heartless. So what he does is he goes on for 20 pages explaining through all this academic jargon why he would not do this. And he pulls out all sorts of like Levi-Bruhl, and he even quotes some Marx, and he throws in all of these different great thinkers, you know, to back up his claim, and uses a very complicated language all his own, but it's quite different. I think one of the things that needs to be explained about Finnegan's Wake that might be a misconception is that Finnegan's Wake changes style. I mean, you would think that that being obscure and abstract all of the time, that it's all kind of just one blanket style for the entire 628-page length of its pages, but it's not. It's multivalent. It changes like the wind would change. And like I said before, very specific things are explored, although within an abstract context.
We're talking to Adam Harvey. His performance at Theater Work this coming weekend is called Finnegan's Wake, The Tale of Shem the Penman. It's on July 7th, 8th, and 9th, and that's Friday and Saturday at 8 in the evening and Sunday at 2 in the afternoon. That's at Theater Work on Rufina Circle. Having heard you read that really makes me think about the different ways that you can take Joyce in. You can read it aloud. You can have somebody else read it aloud. You can read it quickly. You can read it slowly, looking up each word.
Yeah.
What are the different ways that you use to take this material in? And then how do you use that understanding to give back to a theater audience?
I guess I've used all of the different techniques that you just talked about, or all of the different paces that you just described. I've absolutely packed my bookshelves with supplementary, you know, works helping me understand the text. But at the same time, you have to kind of go with instinct as far as what, you know, as far as how this should be presented. So the technique that ultimately has to be relied upon is getting the text onto your palate, getting the text internalized into your body, so that my tongue knows this text almost better than I do. I could recite some of this text, the stuff that I've memorized. I could recite while I'm composing a grocery list, doing my laundry. I mean, that's how well the body needs to know the text before it can come out in the way that you want it to. I think the Brits call it DLP, dead letter perfect. And at every moment, you need to be ready to just spout it out. And now, once you've got that, then you can start writing it. You know, you can start letting the flow of the language inform how you're going to perform. And within that, of course, you try to bring in your own knowledge of what you've known through all the studies and all of the different supplementary books.
Now, I mean, there's a lot of supplementary books. There are things that explain what each word means. There are endless amounts of scholarship that's been done about Joyce. And yet a century or the better part of a century has gone by since his works were published. And inevitably there's this, I guess you would call it kind of cultural erosion. I mean, things are lost. Things that were resonant. A song, even if you have the note on what that song was in, you know, 1912 or whatever, it still doesn't have the same resonance for the current listener, viewer, reader.
Well, I think, I mean, one of the resonances you might be able to pick up is one of nostalgia.
Right.
You know, I mean, the idea that there's a bygone era that this is supposed to be describing. But at the same time, I think that particularly once you're up there performing it, or once you're in an audience and you're just being hit with this, what you're getting is a language that you don't understand, but an actual kind of corporeal representation of that language that will put your mind into a state that goes beyond the language, that goes beyond the era that it was intended to describe, that can go straight towards your own personal experience, your own personal understanding. I mean, there was one, I think in particular, there's a quote from Finnegan where he says, "When Irish eyes of welcome were smiling daggers down their backs," And most people would know the song "When Irish Eyes Are Smiling," an old concert hall song that John McCormack sang. But when I first read that, I couldn't help but think about this kid that sang it. And I did in college. I was in a Saroyan play where that song was sung, called "The Time of Your Life." And the actor who played the kid who sings that song, eventually went to the Persian Gulf War and was killed. And he joined the army in order to pay for the education that would eventually get him trained as a good actor and so on. And he was unable to get a grant because Reaganomics had pretty much made it impossible for him, because his mother had written him off as a tax write-off, even though he wasn't living in her house and so on. It was an absolute nightmare. And then he was killed by a grenade accident there. And so it was difficult for a long time for me to get the image of Corey Winkle out of that piece of text. When Irish eyes of welcome were smiling daggers down their backs. And I think to this day it has its place in there. I mean, it doesn't refer to anything that Joyce himself was writing about. It certainly doesn't, meaning, you know, Corey Winkle. He was not prophesying Corey Winkle. I mean, that would be, you know, that would be beyond the pale. But what he was doing was he was for a moment saying, you know, that this is something that somebody will resonate with in some way, somehow, in some form. You can take something out of this at some point, maybe not at every moment in Finnegan's Wake, but there'll be a moment that hits you. And you may not even know what it is at first, but there's going to be something in your own personal experience that you resonate with.
I suppose that there's a similar experience that many people have listening to music of other centuries. I mean, people listen to Bach and Handel, Baroque music, bring their experience to it, bring a resonance to it. Nobody talks about loss of context in that.
No. And in fact, I think a lot of people – I've had a lot of people describe the experience of watching these performances, and I've done three chapters. I've performed three chapters so far for different Joyce events. And a lot of people describe it as opera. I mean, you don't go to the opera in order to experience – in order to understand what they're saying. I mean, most people don't understand German or French or Italian, and yet they go to the opera. And I think it's the exact same principle here. And in fact, I've talked with concert pianists who describe and we find common ground in the sense that what you've done, for them it's their hands. Their hands have memorized the piece to such an extent that they could play it while they're composing their grocery list or whatever. The same kind of vigilance has to be upheld during the performance of the pieces. I mean, the exact same. I don't think there can be any serious difference.
Let's talk about the world of Joyce scholarship, which has a lot of drama and complexity in it as well.
Yeah.
First of all, what's the relationship like between amateur and professional Joyce scholars? I mean, here you are, an artist, an actor, working with this stuff, and certainly bringing what you one might call scholarship to it, and then there are people who work in universities.
Yeah, yeah. I actually, you know, that it's a very mutually supportive community of people. The academic conferences, which up until now have been the only places where I've really presented my work. I felt like it was important to take my work to that community of people before presenting it to the general public. They are extraordinarily supportive of the non-academic. I mean, I don't think you would ever get that in any other, like, academic community. But they always welcome non-academics to come and share their insights, because there's a sense in Joyce, even though his work is complicated, even though his work is absolutely layered with allusions and very complicated fields of thought, areas of study and so on, there is a sense of just a basic understanding, a basic experience that we can all tie into. And so I've never found a more supportive academic community than the people who write on Joyce and the people who study Joyce and the people who have made Joyce their careers.
Now, there's also the estate of James Joyce and its executor, I guess you would say, Stephen Joyce.
Right. Right. Well, he has a horrible, he's developed an absolutely terrible relationship with the scholarly community.
Now, he's the grandson of James.
Yeah, he's the grandson of James Joyce. And he and his name is Stephen James Joyce, and he insists upon being given the entire title. And he took over the estate in the 1980s and has run the relationship between the estate and the community of scholars that study Joyce's works into the ground. It's been a really, really tragic thing that's happened. One can go back and forth about what is going through Stephen Joyce's mind as he allows things to deteriorate the way he does. The short and long of it is, I think that he's just very, very, very protective of his relationship to his grandfather. And if you look at Stephen Joyce's biography, I don't think he received a whole lot of support from anyone other than his grandfather. He had a whole entourage of people to compete with for the man's attention. And not all of those people were necessarily well-intentioned. They wanted to have their photograph taken with the greatest author of the 20th century and that kind of stuff. And meanwhile, there's a kid who wants a family, you know. And he didn't have much of an interest in literature or anything like that. And yet he was born into this literary environment into which he didn't have much of a place. And so I think that sense of bitterness has informed his attitude towards scholarship. I think he's become overtly hostile towards them. He's more than once told them that he would make them all pay for what they did. And he always keeps it more or less obscure as to what they've done.
What they've actually done.
What they've actually done. And I've had a horrible time trying to get him to give me permission.
Now, you need permission to even recite a chapter aloud in public?
No. I need permission in order to charge admission.
Uh-huh.
And so that's the reason why the show is free.
Now, this show, this upcoming show is free.
Yeah, it's absolutely free.
But people are allowed to make donations.
Well, they are.
And in fact, let's talk about your upcoming, not only are you doing this performance mm-hmm. at Theater Work, but you're going to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival for the entire month of August.
Right.
That's a great honor. Not everybody gets to go to the Fringe Festival.
Well, and, you know, the Fringe is actually, you know, it is probably the most famous and prestigious theater festival in the world. But the works are not juried. You don't have to be juried there. You just have to be willing to throw down the money. And, it is a very expensive proposition. But, it's a real pleasure. I mean, the reason I'm able to go to Edinburgh with this is that permission is not necessary in the United Kingdom in order to perform Joyce's works. And there's some legal loopholes that have made that possible for me. But in the United States, no, it's under ironclad copyright. Sonny Bono, the late Sonny Bono, is the one that we all have to thank for this. He extended... The Sonny Bono Act of 1998, the Copyright Term Extension Act of 1998, extended Finnegan's Wake's copyright until the year 2034.
Good heavens.
Yeah. It's all basically to protect corporate logos like Mickey Mouse and so on from entering the public domain. And authors and their estates and their beneficiaries are really the ones who have kind of accidentally benefited from this.
So all that said, you are not charging admission, but people may donate so that you can keep up this work and take it to Edinburgh, Scotland.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm paying for it myself. I'm paying for all of this myself. And I mean, I hope to get some attention as a result of putting it up at Edinburgh. I hope to win some awards and so on. The general advice is don't go to Edinburgh unless you're going to win, you know, their prizes and so on. And I feel like after about 12 years that this is ready. This is ready to go and this is ready to be seen.
Now, what does reading Joyce, especially as extensively as you've done, teach you? I would think, not having done anything like that myself, that it would first of all teach you patience.
Yeah. An enormous amount of patience. And it was a good thing for me because I was horribly impatient when I first started reading Joyce. I was, you know, in my early 20s. And I wanted to conquer the world overnight, and I saw this enormous body of extraordinarily complicated literature sitting in front of me, and I realized that if I really want to be arrogant like that, And, you know, if I really want to puff myself up, I need to have some knowledge underneath my belt. I can't just stand around and let my talent do all the speaking for me. So I decided to pretty much drop out and inform my talent with something more than just my own desire to be seen. I think it's extraordinarily important for people to not necessarily take the limelight until they feel they have something to share. That's actually something I picked up from Judith Malina of the Living Theater. She was the one that really drove that point home when she visited Santa Fe. I guess it was about 14 years ago. And it always kind of makes you groan when you see somebody who just wants to be seen.
Well, that basically speaks of a kind of maturity which is not necessarily a hallmark of American culture.
Well, American culture is so consumer driven. I mean, everybody wants to own things. I mean, it's not enough to just have an experience. You want to possess it. And I think it's that basic idea of possession that has pretty much quashed so much potential in so many people who would otherwise be brilliant. You know, I mean, they allow themselves to become dazzled by the glamour that they see on the screen, and they forget that you really need to have something to share before you can present yourself like that. I mean, you see it so often, even with the people who do make it big like that, because they're beautiful, because they have this extraordinary talent, and it becomes quite sad when you see that they ultimately don't have anything to share other than that beauty.
You have also done an unusual thing, which is that you have studied Peruvian Amazonian shamanism.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if there was a connection between your studies of shamanism and your work with James Joyce.
Well, shamanism in Peru, and shamanism as it should properly be done, really has to do with helping people. I mean, it's ultimately supposed to be about connecting yourself to people who are in need of your help. And it's not about creating magic. It's not about making sparks fly out of your fingertips, although that might have been part of the reason why I wanted to study it when I was younger. But I was immediately corrected because I happened to stumble upon a very good teacher who worked with the poorest of the poor. And in the ceremonies that he conducted, it was always about understanding these people, helping them through, helping them try to bite through these demons that were possessing them and so on, and to lift their spirits. And that was where my talents as an actor suddenly discovered a field wherein they could express themselves, because they were expressing themselves through something that I felt mattered, that I could say, yes, it matters that I'm doing this. You know, I'm taking the center stage because I am helping these people, or at least I'm trying to help them. Maybe, I mean, I experienced so many failures in trying to help. You know, I mean, you don't just, the best of intentions almost never result in the best of results. But anyway, one of the connections then that I had with shamanism, you were talking about, I think you were talking earlier about when you cloister yourself in and you write, you separate yourself from the outside world. Well, shamanism was in fact a way for me to connect to the outside world to a certain extent while I was making these studies, this kind of shamanic apprenticeship that I underwent with Jorge Gonzalez in Peru, really helped to inform my work with a sense of what is real, of what is truly important. And at the same time, shamanism does indeed have a marvelous mystical quality to it. And I don't want to talk too much about, like, mysticism in connection to shamanism, because I think it's actually a very down-to-earth discipline, shamanism. But you do try to conjure a spirit when you're up there dancing and you're up there singing and you're trying to get people's spirits going. You're actually trying to channel something. And in that sense, I don't know how I could possibly have performed, say, a single chapter, a full chapter of 30 pages long of Finnegan's Wake, standing up there, sweating to death in some cases, without that training behind me. Because one of the things that I was taught was that there's a place, there's a threshold that you meet, but it's an illusory threshold. You can tap into an absolutely limitless source of energy that will carry you through any task that you need to get through, provided that there's a sense that you're trying to bring something to the others. You know, in this case, it would be an actor bringing something to his audience, you know. But I think it's a very, very, very quick step from shamanism to get to that place. And although I would not describe my Finnegan's Wake performance as shamanism per se, it does share a lot of those qualities in the sense that you're trying to create a space. You're trying to create kind of what Peter Brook would have called a holy moment or a holy like a holy theater, wherein suddenly everybody's on the same page, everybody's on the same wavelength, everybody is thinking pretty much the same thought or at least feeling the same thing. Everybody's heart is beating at the exact same rate. And that I've had a few experiences like that. It also depends on the audience and their receptivity to it, of course.
Have you found that when you're performing Finnegan's Wake or other James Joyce work, mm-hmm. at times that people get, I mean, it's almost like a spell. People get drawn into the spell of that and they're really with you.
Yeah, it can happen. I cannot promise that that's what happens every time. It can be distracted by something as simple as somebody who has a cough that's out of control, or maybe it's me. I just, you know, it's like my wavelength is not hitting these people, and if I were maybe a little bit more focused, I'd be able to bring them into it. I can't say that it happens every time. I'd love to be able to say that it happens every time. I feel like as I'm working more and more in the theater, I'm starting to learn some of the tricks and the dynamics of bringing people into that experience. But
it happens enough so that what you recognize it when you see it, and so do your audiences.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, it can be really great. I mean, that's what we're all shooting for. That's what every actor is really ultimately hoping for, is to create that moment where suddenly we're all in the same bubble. Yeah.
Adam Harvey, I'd like to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Adam Harvey's work, his theater piece, Finnegan's Wake, The Tale of Shem the Penman, opens this Friday night, July 7th at 8 o'clock. It runs July 7th and 8th at 8 o'clock and Sunday, July 9th at 2 o'clock at Theater Work, which is on Rufina Circle right here in Santa Fe. The number at Theater Work is 471-1799.
You can also call me at 795-9883.
795-9883, and that's the number for Adam Harvey.